Well, welcome today to Digital Immortals, Preserving Life Beyond Death, and we're going to go ahead and jump right in. So this this idea of digital immortals is really based in sort of what happens to our digital selves after we pass away, sort of from an archival standpoint and from a technological standpoint. So let's start by sort of exploring that for a moment. And there seems to be a slide missing. Well, isn't that great? So nobody really knows what the afterlife holds, but it's we all want to control it in some way. And pent up in our desire to understand the afterlife is a desire to leave something behind, as to have some control over it. So this is the sort of psychological underpinnings of why we leave objects behind, imbue them with meaning, and through this process, we subconsciously preserve our identity, and it's a way to achieve immortality. And so that's why we leave family heirlooms, like you see those here on the screen or photographs. And a funny aside is, if you've ever wondered where the merchandise and antique store comes from, it actually comes from failed family heirlooms. They've lost their meaning and they've been discarded. So I like to think of those as failed heirloom stores. But as Chuck Palahniuk said, he said that we all die, but the goal isn't to live forever, but the goal is to create something that will. And if you stop and look around, we're not necessarily collecting physical things any longer, like those things we just saw on the screen. It's likely that the laptops and iPhones that you have in your hands right now, and the things that they access in the cloud, have the ability to tell us more about you than we could ever dream of knowing about our ancestors from what they left behind. So if you run the numbers, we're actually creating a lot of digital data. So 200 million Twitter users post a total of 95 million tweets per day. That's a lot of 140-character posts. 845 million Facebook users post 250 million photos each day, or maybe that's each month. I'm not sure which. But in either case, it's a lot of photos. And the average Facebook user creates about 90 different pieces of content each month. And so just so we understand scale for a moment, this is a infographic that shows the relative size of photography collections. You'll notice the bottom corner is zoomed in, and we've got Facebook, and smaller than that is Flickr, and much, much smaller than that is Instagram, and then that tiny dot in the bottom left is the Library of Congress. Sorry, Bill. But the thing we think about all of this data is that it is created by people who are mortal, and we each with their own story and their own life. And that really presents the question, as we are documenting our lives digitally and doing so in very high volumes, what will we leave behind? Perhaps we'll leave behind gigabytes of data for our heirs, but what will that data mean to our heirs? And is it possible to experience this information in a way that creates a digital representation of ourselves? So I've gathered a group here today to talk about just that. So I'm Evan Carroll. I'm from the Digital Beyond, and I am the co-author of a book called Your Digital Afterlife, and where we explore this topic. Also joining me is Airdrie Miller, to my right, and she is the widow of early blogger Derek Miller, and she's going to share her experience of tending to Derek's digital life after he passed away last May. And I'd like to express, on our behalf, our deepest condolences to you, Airdrie. Next, we have Adam Ostrow. He's going to share his observations on digital life and how we might preserve a digital self. He recently spoke on the topic about, last year, I believe it was, at TED Global, the idea of creating a digital self from our social media posts. And then we'll hear from Bill Lafergy. He's a digital archivist and manager. Oh, I'm not clicking, am I? Manager of the National Digital Information and Infrastructure Preservation Program at the Library of Congress. And I think I got all of those words in there, Bill. And then finally, we'll hear from Richard Banks. He's a senior interaction designer at Microsoft Research, and he is the author of The Future of Looking Back. And he will share with us the changing nature between the physical and the digital and how it relates to our heirlooms. So I'm going to turn it over to Airdrie now.
Hi, I'm Airdrie Miller. I'm from Vancouver, BC. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I just started a Twitter account again. I had one, but I deleted it last year when my husband passed away. I just had too much stuff out there. So I felt the need for privacy at that point. But I would love it if you would all follow me, and I can get that going again. So I'm just going to tell you a very short love story. I met my husband, Derek, in 1994. We were married in 1995. That's our wedding album. We had engagement photos done. Hands up if anyone's had an engagement photo done. Yes. So that was in 1994 as well. Do you remember film? We used to take pictures with film. This is us posing at Burnaby Lake in British Columbia. Do you remember photo albums? We used to put the photos into the album. This is our honeymoon album. We traveled 1,500 miles through California. Now they call it scrapbooking. But we used to take all the little bits of paper and, you know, hotel receipts and stubs to parks and photos and tuck them all into one album. And I treasure these. I have them. You can see they're going a little bit brown now because they're quite old. In 1998, we started having babies. This is my daughter, Marina. Very chubby, cute. And there's Marina with her sister, Meredith. And do you remember making triples or doubles when you go to the photo mart? We used to make triples, one for each set of grandparents, and then, of course, one for our album. That was 2001. Is anyone a parent in here? Hands up. So you know how busy it is being a parent. I was very, very busy making babies, parenting, and only just recently have I had the time to look back and reflect, and that's part of what I'm doing here today. But there was a huge shift, and it was exciting. And the shift was digital. And all of a sudden, the photo albums just stopped. There's no more photo albums in our house. It became digital cameras, digital photos, digital videos, YouTube, music, digital love letters. No more love letters from anyone. All email, text message now, sexting, all that exciting stuff. Right? Online photo sharing, Flickr. I think my husband had about 10,000 photos on Flickr. And then online diaries. Both my husband and I were bloggers and podcasters, which is why we're a bit techie and geeky. And my husband was a prolific writer, and that had became his digital legacy. So it was a really exciting time. We were very excited. And then my husband got diagnosed with cancer. This picture was taken a couple days before he passed away, last May. We had a home hospice set up, and Coca-Cola was our sponsor. It's a long story. So what I wanted to bring into this whole picture today is feelings. I'm the woman, after all, at the table. How was I feeling? I want you to really think about feelings today. I was feeling sad. I was feeling worried. I was feeling hopeful. I was, you know, hoping for a cure. I was feeling anguish as I saw the cure didn't come, stage 4 cancer. And I was feeling nothing at all, denial. Denial that death was coming. At the same time, wanting death to come. So think about feelings today. When Derek passed away, this is all that happened. His website crashed. He wrote something called his last post that went viral on Twitter and crashed the servers. I don't even understand what a server is, okay? He taught me how to use email on our first date. Luckily, he has some techie friends who helped us out. His domain's almost expired. I recently got a phone call from GoDaddy, and they're like, we've been trying to email you, and you owe us $800. And I'm like, oh, okay, here's my credit card number. I don't know what's going on, but luckily they're still up. Twitter keeps telling me to add him as a friend because I restarted a new Twitter account. You should friend Derek Miller. I'm like, yeah, really, he's dead. He's my husband. It's awkward. People are still writing on my husband's Facebook page. I'm trying to get his blog turned into a book. This is proving to be difficult because not only is the publishing industry on a decline, nobody really wants to talk about cancer or death. And I've started moving on. I recently put a profile on Match.com, and I've been on 5 dates. So life moves on. And what I really want you to all think about is, where is this all going to be in 30 years? Will his blog still be up? Will Flickr even still exist? Where will my baby photos all go? What happens when I die? Only I know these special passwords. And will anyone really care? So that's what I want you to keep in mind today as all the technology people talk about more big things. Thank you. Pass it down.
So hi, I'm Adam Ostro. I'm the executive editor at Mashable. We cover digital culture. And really what first got me interested in this topic of what happens to our social media profiles after we die was Derek's post, which I found on Twitter as it was going super viral. How many of you guys have read it? I'm just curious. Okay, so a good number of you. So for those of you that haven't, this is kind of how it started out. I mean, so basically what Derek did was create this post that his family published right after he died. It was really, you know, introspective and personal, and I just thought such a beautiful thing to do. But then it really got me thinking about, you know, we are all just creating tons and tons of data, and the reality is that we all are going to die. So I think the question about what happens to that data is incredibly interesting. And something else that made me further think about the topic and ultimately took shape in a talk I gave at TED last summer, was a couple different things. One of them was when I walked into a deli, as I normally do in New York, to get my lunch. And it was like the most bizarre thing ever. I checked in on Foursquare to this place called Organique, which is like a buffet-style sandwich place, whatever, in New York. And I got a phone call, and someone behind the deli goes, is there an Adam here? And I'll just show you what happened.
Hello, hey.
Hello, is this Organic?
Yes.
Hi, I'm looking for a customer. He's there right now. His name is Adam. Can you call him to the phone?
Can you describe him to me?
Adam Ostro. He's bald.
Adam? You Adam? Hello?
Adam?
Yeah.
Death can catch you anywhere, anytime, even at the Organic.
Who is it?
Go to ifidie.net before it's too late.
Okay.
So it wasn't exactly what I wanted to hear on Tuesday. But in any event, I mean, this really got me thinking. And what ifidie does, it's a service that basically lets you create basically a list of instructions of what to do when you die. So if you want to post, like, have Facebook messages set to go out or a YouTube video that you want to have published upon your death, you can do that. You can set essentially what's like a digital executor, someone that's going to take care of your social media profiles after you die. And there's a lot of services that are doing similar things to that now. It's kind of like an emerging industry. But what got me further thinking about this topic was some of the stuff we just cover on an ongoing basis at Mashable. So we write about advances in data and artificial intelligence. And what I got to thinking is that kind of some of the numbers that Evan shared, I mean, on average, we're all going to create hundreds of thousands of pieces of content online during our lifetimes. And if you think at the rate at which we're now able to analyze data, huge amounts of data, and I'm sure we'll hear about that in the Library of Congress, I think what's ultimately going to become possible is this idea to recreate someone in the digital sphere based on analyzing those tens of thousands of photos and videos and status updates and blog posts. And essentially, I think it goes beyond just having a much better idea of who your ancestors are, but I think creates some really complex questions about what we want to have happen to our digital legacy after we die, and if, you know, that's to be exploited by commercial interests, or if it becomes something that we want to make part of the grieving process. And those are the questions I think we'll explore in part here today.
Turn over to Bill now.
Hi, I'm Bill Fergie, professional archivist at the Library of Congress. And I'm used to taking care of information in an institutional setting. What we do is we carefully choose material, we preserve it, and we make it available to people who want to use it. And among other things, this helps people connect with their ancestors. Now, what you see on the screen here is an Ambro-type portrait in the Library of Congress. It's of a Civil War soldier. And just a couple of days ago, the Washington Post reported that an ancestor of this person recognized him as long-lost Uncle Dave, who was a soldier who was killed in 1863. He was 19 years old. Now, today, everybody is their own archivist. And many of us have very large collections, personal digital collections, that we have to decide what to keep. We have to decide how to do it. There isn't a big institution that's going to help us or actually do the work for us. And what this means is that in the future, we're probably not going to find Uncle Dave in an institutional setting. Instead, if those pictures survive, they're going to be in messy personal digital collections that probably are living very tenuous life on somebody's device or out in the cloud someplace. And if they're on the cloud, out in the cloud, they're going to be among hundreds of billions, trillions of other photographs and other documentary items that are out there on the web. Now, the big problem we face is that we have these huge personal digital collections, but we're, most of us, not everybody, but most of us are pretty poor managers of this data. We don't really take the time to organize our digital lives. And of course, we all back up our files regularly, right? I myself am guilty of not doing that as regularly as I should. So what this boils down to is that most people just are not aware of their archival role with their own personal materials. And what this does is it puts their digital legacy at risk, and particularly for their family and their future and the people who are interested in them in the future. So what are we going to do about this? I think there's two sort of big issues here, and they fall on two different groups. First of all, libraries and archives need to be more involved in personal digital archiving. Now, the problem is, or the issue or the matter, is too big for any one institution or all the institutions in the world to be able to collect all this stuff and preserve it and keep it available. It's going to come down to the individual who's going to have to do this work. So what libraries and archives need to do is really raise awareness about the issue and get people to care about this. And we also need to provide some basic guidance for people to get started working with their digital materials. And we do this, I'm happy to say, at the Library of Congress. We've just started trying to put out some basic guidance to people to get them starting to work with their digital materials. We have it on the web at digitalpreservation.gov. The second issue and the second community that really needs to get involved here is the technological community. We really need to see far better support for personal digital archiving. We were very happy to have Tim O'Reilly speak at a meeting last year, one of our meetings, and he said that personal archiving functionality really needed to be baked into tools to be able to permit a distributed stewardship mindset. And he said the absolute truth is that we just can't depend on institutions to be able to do this for us. I'm not sure we would even want to depend on institutions to do this for us. So there are really two big creative challenges here. One, we desperately need tools and systems to get control over our personal digital content. We also need tools and systems to be able to help us cope with the vast material that's left behind by our loved ones who may not have pulled their stuff together as well as we might have wished. These tools have to be highly automated and very easy to use because otherwise they won't be used. And we need new approaches to be able to preserve this personal content, both for ourselves and for the future. And I think really what it comes down to is porting the values that libraries and archives have represented really for centuries to be able to get those values out into people's lives and so that people can really take positive steps to be able to preserve their materials. So I'm really talking about helping people keeping their content usable and persistent and available over time. It basically comes down to helping people find Uncle Dave in the future. Unless they take those steps, it's going to be very hard to do. Now, I know this is a huge challenge. It's going to take some time to get it right, I'm sure. But I think as awareness of what's at stake grows, that we're going to see some innovative breakthroughs. It's just too important.
Great. Thanks, Bill. Good afternoon. My name is Richard Banks. I'm an interaction designer at Microsoft Research in Cambridge in the UK. But like a lot of people, I got interested in this space because of things that happened to me personally. So, for example, in 2005, my grandfather passed away, and he left behind a suitcase full of a couple of hundred physical photos that kind of went on this weird journey from family member to family member, each of us kind of opening it up and having a look through it. And it really got me thinking about, well, even in terms of photography, what will be my own legacy? And I figured out, well, I'm taking about 5,000 photos a year at the moment, which I think probably for this audience is a little low. You know, if I extrapolate to my average date of death, if you like, I'll probably end up leaving about 200,000 digital photos to my daughter. So this is kind of a recurring thing that people have mentioned already, this kind of aspect of dealing with quantity, and particularly searching for meaning through quantity. And I think that's a big debate, this question of kind of like, can machines make meaning from things, or does it always have to be some kind of human intervention, like the photo albums, to get a sense of what mattered and what didn't matter? I think it's important to note that quantity can be a positive thing. You know, I think it's amazing that I can walk around with 60 gigs of music in my pocket and hit random, you know, and hear songs that I haven't heard for a long time. So digital things have a serendipitous quality that can be quite magical, and there may be ways of thinking about experiencing other people's content in the same way, as being kind of spontaneous and unexpected. This is a device that was developed in Cambridge called the SenseCam, and it's basically a camera that you wear that's triggered by sensors to take photos automatically. And if it isn't triggered, it goes ahead and takes them anyway at about a rate of one every 30 seconds, I think. And it's proving incredibly useful in kind of research into, for example, dementia or a dietary planning, where you can actually see through this device what people really ate rather than what they told you that they ate. But it does raise this kind of question about this tipping point that we're at, where in the past we might have regretted that we didn't know enough about our grandparents and their parents, and we'd wish we'd got the stories out of them. And in the future, we may be sick of the amount of quantity, you know, the quantity of things that we know about them, and the tiny little details of coffee shops that they checked into, and, you know, all these kind of mundane things that they put online. And mundanity has kind of a nice quality of its own. You know, we've interviewed people who've received diaries from their parents and their grandparents, and often the little mundane entries are the things that really give them some sense of insight into their ancestors' life. So, you know, people often, you know, we'll ask people, do you plan to keep your tweets? And they'll just kind of say, no, my tweets have no value. But actually, these mundane little things are often the things that really fill out somebody's life, which is problematic. I mean, this issue of kind of physicality is sort of a recurring one. And I'm particularly concerned by the fact that a lot of the physical things from our home are disappearing and becoming digital. My sister and I have this constant argument about this beautiful Japanese coffee table that my mother has and who's going to get it. And we talk about kind of cutting it in half. But homes are full of kind of physical things that are part of your memories as well, just because they've been around. So these instances of digital things are different from the permanence of physical things that occupy our homes, for example. And then services like Spotify raise really interesting questions about ownership. You know, I don't own the songs on Spotify, but I manipulate them into playlists and things. So in terms of inheriting something from Spotify, what the inheritance will actually be of my manipulations of the system, and not the CDs that I bought or the songs that I own, but the way that I've kind of put together these digital things that are actually sort of elsewhere. And the key issue, I think, is that even with digital things, is that files on your hard drive tend to be little entities of their own that you can drag around and do things with. And as soon as you put something online, it explodes into being a cluster of related data even if you take a JPEG and put it up on Flickr, suddenly it arranges itself. So there are seven different sizes of JPEG that you can pick from on Flickr, from little thumbnails to large things. And all these kind of rich properties that interconnect one another are amazing things. But actually getting your arms around a cluster of data is problematic. And this is a report by Nicholas Felton. You probably know his Feltron report that he releases every year. And this is one he did a couple of years, assembling all the data that he knew about his father after his father passed away. And I thought it was this kind of interesting notion of using digital things as a source of data to recreate the stories about people. And I don't have a sense from Nicholas about what matters in the data here, but we're all producing this data as kind of a side effect of our lives. This is about digital placeness, basically. You know, the Emory University recently received Salman Rushdie's laptops that he actually used for authoring a number of his novels. And you can go to their library and sit down with a virtual version of his desktop, which unfortunately is a Mac, and rifle through his stuff. And actually, in the description, it says, you know, come and visit Salman Rushdie's archives and have a rifle through his wastebasket. And this is kind of sense like somehow you'll get some insight into the way his process through the arrangement of through the digital environment that he was in, not just the individual files that were part of it. And finally, I think there's an interesting question about kind of our personal ownership of files. You know, when you talk to somebody about the physical things or the digital things on their hard drives in their homes, they have a strong sense of kind of owning them, even though they might not know exactly what folder they're in. But when you start to talk to people about putting photos up on Facebook, they start to talk in terms of a social contract with the people with whom they share. And often they're actually taking photos without any intent to keep it for themselves, but with the explicit intent to share it with others. And obviously, once the photo gets up there, it starts being commented on and acted on by others. So that people would consider it extremely rude to remove a photo from Facebook because of the offending people who've kind of participated in it. So there's this question about whether, when you put a photo on Facebook, it's still yours, and what rights you have to the kind of activity that starts to kind of collect around it. So those are a few things that kind of properties of digital things that are clearly different than physical things and often offer both amazing opportunities and kind of problems when it comes to thinking about kind of history and personal archives.
So in the interest of brevity, I gave each of my panelists, including myself, 3 minutes for that introduction. We see where that went. let's jump into this subject a bit. So we've talked about this idea of digitally preserved self, and Adam sort of brought it to the forefront here. Very quickly, let's talk about what it would take and what elements we would need to start thinking about that. And I'll hand that down to Richard or Bill to get that one started.
What it would take to start to do a digital self? I think there's a question about, first of all, you know, when you don't even get to the technological questions about exactly what its purpose is, mm-hmm. you know, because who it is that this digital self is representing and how it's different from just receiving an archive of somebody else, you know, because there's a sense within the digital self that there's actually a person there or a sense of a person there. Like we've done some field research, for example, just talking to people who've received stuff after they've been bereaved, and this kind of question about how you gradually put things away and how you get on with your life, I think, is an important one. And I know there have been articles written, you know, in which I think there was an article I read last year about a girl whose mother passed away, and her mother wrote her letters to be opened on every single one of her birthdays until she was 21, and she was quite young at the time, and then one final letter on her wedding, and she wrote about the fact that she never was able to come to terms with that, with her mother's death, until the final letter was opened, because there was always this sense that something else was coming up. So I think there's this kind of so putting stuff away starts to be an important kind of property when it comes to kind of a sense of legacy. I think there's an interesting question about the changing nature of heirloom things over time. You know, so my mother has some photos on her wall of my great uncle, and I never knew him, and he's sitting on horseback, and he looked after the dogs at a big stately home. If you imagine kind of Downton Abbey, he was the guy who kind of looked after the hounds. And amazing photos of him up on this horse. And when I look at these photos, I kind of see the odd way he's sitting and the odd things he's wearing and these kind of archaeological aspects of the photo, whereas my mother sees these kind of personal aspects. So I think there's this kind of opportunity for thinking about the recurrence of a sense of digital self as being an archaeological thing, rather than necessarily something that has the danger of extending the process of bereavement.
Yeah, I will stay true to my professional roots and say that it really comes down to what we call metadata or provenance. In other words, you really have to know the context of what this information relates to. I think about some of the information that I've put out on social networks and elsewhere. And I think if it were looked at in and of itself, I would hesitate to say that it would give an accurate portrayal of myself. Hopefully it wouldn't be too far off, but there's a lot of nuance and a lot of context that I think really needs to be brought to bear, particularly when you have so much information. It's one thing when all you have is a few items that are left from a relative. You're left to fill in many, many blanks. As someone mentioned, we may have too much stuff from our loved ones. And I think the key is going to be able to make sense of what it all means. And that has to come down to context and how these things relate to each other. And often what that means is that you have to have some additional data about particular objects. And coming by that data can be extremely difficult. In some cases, it can be automatically generated. In some cases, you've got to put it in there yourself. Ideally, photographs on Flickr will have, you'll put in tags, you'll put in descriptions, you'll put in a good title, you'll organize them very well into sets. And people who really do a good job at that, you can get a very, very good idea. They tell a very, very good story. Other people, they just load stuff onto Flickr without much in the way of additional information. And it's much harder to kind of tell a story or to tell an accurate story from that type of information.
So, Adam, in your TED Talk, you kind of presented some ideas for what, assuming that advances in artificial intelligence and data processing, and many of you probably heard Stephen Wolfram talking about all the things we can do with processing of data earlier today. What do you think, from a sort of visionary standpoint, what do you think a digitally preserved self might look like?
Sure. Well, I think there's a certain inevitability to being able to create a digital self. I mean, I think Ray Kurzweil is another one of the keynotes here. He talks all the time about exponential growth and Moore's Law and the implications that has, not just on semiconductors, but really on all facets of life. And what I think that means, and you're already seeing this on the internet, so bandwidth increasing exponentially, the amount of video that's going to be produced is increasing exponentially. And when you start to analyze video instead of just text and photos, I think that's something that's really important, because you're going to be able to get a lot more from people in terms of, you know, what's their tone, what are their beliefs, and really read into it a lot more than you will a status update about, you know, where you're eating lunch or something like that. And I think what it ultimately could look like, when you also start to think about advances being made in robotics and artificial intelligence scenarios like that, there's robots now that, like MIT Media Lab is testing, for instance, that can start to understand human emotion to an extent. When you start to think about that, I think ultimately what you get, potentially, the potential is there many years down the line, to create essentially a visual representation, whether it's a robot or a hologram or something that looks and feels like you and is drawing on this data to create a real representation of who that person was when they were alive.
So I'm going to go back to what Richard was saying is, should we do this? And I think a lot of times when we talk about technology and what's possible, it's very easy for us to get caught up in what we can do and what we might do. But should we do that? And I think Erdrew, you might be the best person at the table to answer, should we do that, based upon your experience?
Well, I don't know what I would say to Robot Derek when I go out on a date. See you later. You know, I don't think so.
So we were talking earlier, you know, if we had a Robot Derek or robot anyone for that instance, you know, would it be improper to turn them off? Or would it be improper to put them in the closet for a period of time and, you know, someone quipped, maybe we should make sure there's always we store them in pairs of two so they can converse amongst themselves. But the idea that we're creating something that has to be managed, and I think that this is sort of leading to the idea of if we're creating something new to be managed, do we want to head in that direction, and do we think that that's even valuable for society? Anyone down there want to take a stab at that one?
Well, I mean, I think what's really important and people are going to start to need to do is really view their digital assets the same way they view their physical assets, mm-hmm. and start to really think and both brief their loved ones, whether it's in the form of a will or something like that, and really let it be known what their intentions are, what they want to have happen to their data after they die, whether they want it to be deleted entirely, whether they want it to be preserved internally, or whether they want to have it be open and let companies, the Library of Congress, whomever, do interesting things with that data.
Right, so this is starting to point towards our fundamental question is, and to steal the title of Richard's book right off there, what does the future of looking back kind of hold? And we talked about sort of this out there version of the digitally preserved self, but realizing that we have such quantity that we're going to have to deal with, what are those? How might, say, in 50 years, my ancestors, or not my ancestors, but probably my children or their children, look back and, you know, maybe from the photos I've taken this week, how will they experience those? Will they experience those? And how can we make sure that those things have meaning? Richard, I feel like you may be the best person to talk about that.
Well, there is a sense that kind of like everything changes and, you know, everything stays the same. You know, that some of these issues have kind of preservation and the creation of an archive and kind of thinking about personal legacy, you know, humans have always been lazy at, and they'll sort of continue to be lazy at them. You know, I remember I didn't really write a will until I had my daughter, you know, and we had our daughter, and there was this kind of sense of responsibility for someone else that kind of pushed me forward to think about my own responsibilities with the things that that I have day to day. I mean, I think 50 years is a long way to think out, and I think at the moment, you know, the big issue is really our relationship to the cloud. You know, so I alluded to the kind of how posting on Facebook isn't just like kind of moving a photo from one folder to another folder. It has particular properties to it, and you know, particularly related to the social. I think one interesting question is the question of possession. You know, so we've done some research just asking people, you know, about this, you know, whether they feel like they're in the physical things, do they feel like they're in the digital things, do they feel like they're in the digital things when they put them online, and that line starts to get more and more blurry when you get online. That, you know, there's all this the social and negotiation stuff I mentioned, and then the relationship to the service and all those kinds of things. And so I did a presentation a couple of weeks ago at the computer science department in Cambridge, and one of the guys in the audience just said to me, "Well, what makes you think that possession really matters?" And you know, and he was quite kind of young guy, so there is this kind of sense of kind of generational thing as well, that some of the issues we're talking about, you know, that maybe we just won't care about keeping things anymore, if you like, and it may be that that's because somebody else takes on that sense of responsibility. Or it may be that we're just producing so much stuff that any individual thing feels like it has no, inherent kind of strong qualities to it. So there is this, at the moment, this kind of change in the sense of possession, if you like. You know, it's not just about moving from physical to digital and kind of missing the record player and missing the rituals of kind of playing CDs and all kind of physicality things. I think within digital, there is this question about whether we feel like things will continue to be ours.
Yeah, the issue of possession is interesting. I would argue now that it would serve your own personal archiving interests to have possession, only because the services that are out there, Facebook, Twitter, whatever, they're not in the forever business. They could go away at any point in time. Even a cloud service that you use right now could go away, and that your data could go with it. We may get to the point where those services are more persistent and robust, and I would still argue that you may not while you may not want physical control, you're still going to want some sort of persistent, enduring control over the material. I think it would be a huge mistake for anybody to rely on the generic cloud or any kind of web service to be able to maintain their legacy.
So let's talk about that idea of trust. And we've already established that the idea of a lifetime's worth of digital data is a lot of data, and we almost incomprehensible at this time because of the rate at which file sizes and all those things are growing. But Bill, is it reasonable for us to think that we can hold on to our digital data, and is it reasonable that we can expect for it to exist any distance into the future? And what would it take to do that?
Well, one of the things I think that has surprised a lot of people over the last 10 years is that so much data on the web has persisted. We used to hear, and I heard talks today about a digital dark age, and it could still happen. Data could still disappear, massive amounts of it. But I think what we do see is data kind of being carried forward. We did some focus groups with some teenagers at the library to get their ideas about the internet, and they were adamant that if they had to be very careful because anything that goes on the internet will last forever. One of them actually said that. So I think the problem, though, is that it's one of too much information. Now, we may end up getting technology which can handle billions and trillions of files with ease. We may be able to get algorithms that can sort through all kinds of data and be able to make sense of it. I'm a little skeptical still that, particularly given the lack of descriptive information about some of this stuff that's out there, that when the owner of this information loses interest in it, I think trying to make sense of that information is going to be very difficult for anybody who goes back and try to sift through all that stuff.
So thinking about the notion of sifting through all those things, Airdrie, it's been just under a year since your husband passed, and you've been working through his content and settling his affairs. I saw you tweeted just yesterday, 2 days ago, that you filed his last tax return. Mm-hmm. So you're sort of in the process of dealing with those things and closing them out. And I guess how much of it have you made your way through? How much of it has been useful to you? And what have you felt as you went through that process?
Oh, well, it's very stressful, taxing on anyone to go through and handle the affairs of your spouse when they pass away. There was a point where I could only do one thing a week, you know, and I'm almost finished, I hope. But then things happen, like I do get a call from GoDaddy and I've totally forgotten about that. Or what about Flickr? Do I have to keep his account up to date? So in a way, I feel like I've been burdened with this long-term chore now to keep his digital life there, and I feel like it's a burden almost.
So this idea of a burden is very interesting to me because in one sense we talk about how the fact that we still have these things can be comforting, they can be useful in the grieving process. On the other hand, the sheer quantity of them and the act of having to deal with them is kind of a burden at the same time. So it seems like we've kind of got a set of mixed emotions.
Well, it's like the urn, you know. You have an urn with ashes and you put it on the mantelpiece and it stayed there for about 6 months. And then around Halloween, I started to feel haunted by it. And I said, okay, this is going away. And so I've put the urn now in a cupboard down below. And occasionally I'll open up the cupboard and say, hello, Derek. But, you know, it's nice to have it off the mantelpiece. Mm-hmm. And I think that might be a good analogy for how most of us are going to want to handle our family's digital legacies, especially if they're just average people. You know?
And so something we hear a lot in this space is Facebook profiles and the fact that they can be memorialized and people can use them as memorials. And it's almost like in some people's sense, I've heard people say that they are, in one sense, very comforting because they're there when they want to go to them. but Facebook has deliberately made changes so that where they're not sort of in your face and there all the time. So it's almost like whatever we design, whatever the digitally preserved self needs to be and the interfaces we use to interact with our data needs to be something that we can go to when we want to go to it, but that isn't ultimately not a burden to us and doesn't show up when we don't want it to, just in the same way that Twitter wants you to follow Derek.
Yeah.
So, Richard, I think you have some thoughts on that, judging by your eyebrow lift momentarily.
I was trying to figure out how to jump in. I think... I've just totally drawn a blank. This question of burden, I think, is kind of an interesting one and one that I kind of wanted to comment on. You know, in the studies we've done with people who've been recently bereaved and inherited objects, you get a sense from them that the things that they've inherited continue to tell them stories about the person who's passed away. So their relationship with that person doesn't necessarily end, and that the things that are left behind can affect that relationship, in positive and negative ways. So there is kind of risk associated with things. So one example, for example, that we found was a guy who inherited a box of rocks from his grandfather, and he had never ever talked about rocks to his grandfather and not expressed any interest in geology or anything related to rocks. And he didn't know his grandfather had an interest in rocks. And so he ended up with this box of rocks, and he ended up confused about his relationship with his father, because he had received this object, which clearly his grandfather had intended for him and is supposed to be sending a message to him, and he hadn't been able to receive the message. And he ended up in this weird position where the box, to a great extent, were valueless to him, but he had the burden of looking after them. So this box of rocks ended up underneath the spare bed in his spare room. And when he moved house one day, they were lost. And he no longer had, and there was this sense of kind of relief that he no longer had these rocks, and they hadn't made it through the move. But this kind of confusion about the relationship and exactly what this person, thought of you, if you like, and what they were thinking about, and all of those kinds of things. The things they lived behind continue that story. And I know when my father passed away, I ended up with the hard drive off his PC, and I had somebody at work make a virtual PC version of it. So suddenly it was on my PC, and when I double clicked it, it launched Windows ME. Which I think he probably bought in like 1992 or something, whenever Windows ME was out. But then I saw this desktop, and I couldn't go any further, because suddenly I was in this space where it was his space. He'd never expected that anybody would go through it in the way that you might expect of the physical things in your home. And I was kind of like, I didn't want to find out things about him that would be unexpected. So these objects aren't just kind of neutral things; they continue to have an effect on the relationships. That are kind of part of the process.
Yeah, I'd say we're actually probably looking at layers of burden. Facebook, for example, if someone you care about has a memorial on Facebook, and I understand the continuing relationship and the value of being able to have that out there in that space and be able to experience it through Facebook, but Facebook probably isn't going to be around forever. Who knows? In 10 years, it may be gone. It may be something completely different. So I think in terms of legacy, what we're really looking at is something like what Richard did. You want a copy of what's on Facebook. And that raises all kinds of questions about what kinds of qualities. Should you have exactly the same qualities? Should it look like Facebook right now? Or do you just copy off certain parts of it? Are you only interested in the text and the pictures? And then you have this virtual copy that you have to somehow maintain, and then you have to explain to people where it came from and how to use it, because, again, in 10 years, well, this came from Facebook. What's Facebook? Looking ahead many, many years, things are going to be radically different, and trying to explain how this information came to be, how it was used, and how it actually served a bereavement or a memorial process is going to be a big part of the story, and you're going to have to make sure that you can tell that.
Yeah, I think this is also, though, what makes the cloud and artificial intelligence so potentially interesting in terms of the future of this. It is that burden piece. So instead of being in your face, it's there when you want to experience it and want to use it. So maybe, and it's more conversational. It's not just, it changes the way we do this. It's not like looking through a box of things. It's like, oh, I really wonder what, you know, what my grandfather thought of the 1992 presidential election, and search it, you know? I think that's the type of stuff that's really interesting, and just like, it's, I think the potential is like as far as your imagination can take it and beyond.
And it seems that if we're able to capture this information, and as Bill, you said earlier, assign the proper metadata to it, we may be able to do as engines like Wolfram Alpha, do, and they can, you can say, what did my father think in 1992? And it comes back with a list of all the things he thought in 1992 and what his perceptions were, and you can see how those changed. This idea of being able to process data on the fly so that we personally don't have to handle that burden.
Right, and when you're thinking about digital, I mean, Facebook's timeline feature, I mean, how many people have you actually gone back more than a couple months on? There's just so much stuff there. It's not like I'm going back and looking what my friends were doing like 6 years ago. I just don't have time for it. But I might want to search it, and like, a memory might pop in my head, and I want to look it up, and I think that's what ultimately could be possible and quite interesting.
And as we start to see those features blur out, and especially when I saw the timeline, my first thought was, this is in a way a digital record of someone's life, and it has this timeline interface, and almost in the same way that when Time Machine came out for the Mac, you were able to go back in the future sort of in this, you know, physical space that they'd set up, but it's kind of the same thing. You can actually go back, you can scroll back down to it and see what's going on there.
So I was just going to jump in and say that somehow there's got to be a way to leverage sentimentality to be able to make this happen. That may be the killer app. And it may also come down to perhaps being able to start to see the possibility of a reconstructed self or a reconstructed loved one to really sort of drive people to really want to flesh this out more fully and to drive the tech community to start going in that direction. Where we are right now, it tends to sort of almost be kind of divergent. I mean, you've got it's like this vastly expanding technological universe with all these different services out there. I'm hoping that we'll see a point where there'll be more convergence to be able to make more sense of all this information that we're creating.
So we're nearing time here, and I'd like to ask one final question and ask the panelists to keep it brief. But what, and I'm particularly interested in your perspective on this, Airdrie, what should we as individuals be doing today? If we want to have a chance of our content lasting and being around, what should we as an individual be doing?
Oh, well, definitely we should be writing our passwords down somewhere. It seems obvious, but it's, you know, I change my password for work every 6 weeks. They make me. And so it's starting to get like, well, I'm changing my password on my Gmail every 2 months as well. You have to write that down in case you do pass away. It's really morbid to think about, but it would be great if there was a service that you could do that. Maybe there is, I don't know. We have a notebook. We had a notebook at home, and I made him write everything in there. But there's still some things he missed, like the administrator password to our Mac. So I can't get on to the administrator.
We can help you reset that.
Okay.
They're not as complicated as those things that Richard makes.
Yeah, go on.
sorry, Richard, I had to.
That's a whole separate panel session.
Something I already alluded to, I mean, I think it's going to become increasingly important to create a digital will, and there's already services that can do that, but I think even if it's just something that you write on a piece of paper and put in your safe, the same way you would a traditional will, I think that's something to be thinking about. I also think as services emerge, I mean, in social media, we've seen services rise and fall in very short periods of time. I think it's really important to just be aware of what those terms of service are. I mean, I know we all skip over them, but there's some really important things in there about who owns the data and what the company's rights to that data are. And I think, you know, making yourself aware of that is something important, and really deciding if this is a topic you care about, deciding whether this service is right for you.
Okay. I would encourage anybody who's interested in this question to go to digitalpreservation.gov. And look at our personal archiving section. We've tried to provide some very basic guidance on just this issue. But if I were to boil it down to what the essentials are, make copies of your stuff, make several copies, put them in different places as far away as possible. Don't have two copies next to your computer at home. Make a copy and send it across town or send it across country. And then also, very briefly, just write descriptions of what the stuff is. Handwritten descriptions, put it in with your will. So if someone knows that there's a hard drive in the safe deposit box or a thumb drive, they know what it is and what's on it.
Are you stunned?
No. I wasn't sure whether we'd run out of time. I mean, I do worry because, you know, as I say, people are inherently lazy and they don't really like to plan. And I do feel like we're kind of in between states here, where
call it laziness. I'd call it in denial. I would call it our society doesn't want to deal with.
I mean, I'm thinking more about you know, you were talking about photo albums, and the reality is that I think a lot of people, you know, end up with boxes full of photos that they intend to make photo albums.
It's benign neglect. You intend to do something with it, but you never get around to it.
I guess a fair way of saying it is people have best intentions, and they often don't kind of fulfill them. So I think it's always been a messy space. You know, that kind of process of handling an estate and figuring out what to do with everything and where everything is, you know, it feels like has always been an uncomfortable one and always been a messy one. So there's a sense for me that's true for the digital too, you know, and will continue to be. I don't think there's necessarily a silver bullet.
So I think we have just a couple of minutes left, and by a couple I mean two. But there are a couple of questions. So I'll take this one over here, and then we'll take this one over here, and if we have time, we'll take yours here. And
I have two quick questions. My mother died December 9th and left a box of letters, which I've been going through with a lot of high-tech sorting equipment like rubber bands. And so there were, and reading those letters, so there's two questions. Reading those letters, it's as if they're standing at the foot of the bed talking to me, because not only is there a lot of mundane, fascinating detail, but also a very crystalline set of voices. And so first, I'd like to ask Adam, you've referenced a couple of times companies that are engaged in thinking through the archiving of this data that we've been talking about. What are they? And second, despite the volume of data, do you all feel as if something is being lost?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of the services, there's a lot. I mean, there's one called 1000 Memories, which is like a kind of crowdsourced solution for, you can basically have your family and friends all contribute different types of content, whether it's text or photos or videos. Evan, you probably have some good.
Yeah, so, and then 1000 Memories is great for preserving sort of data as far as passwords, Legacy Locker, Entrusted. They're all sort of digital estate planning services. Not to sound like I'm self-promoting, but there is a list of these at thedigitalbeyond.com, my website, where you can browse. There's at least 50 different services that offer different types of information there.
Yeah, and on the data side, part of the inspiration for my talk was a talk that Deb Roy at MIT gave about big data, which is really interesting.
So to be respectful for time, I don't think I can take yours, but let's come visit me afterwards, and we'll be sure to answer your question. But in conclusion, I'd like to encourage you to make sure you rate our panel. I'd like you to encourage you to check out Richard's book, The Future Looking Back, and then I would be remiss, and my publisher would be mad at me if I didn't say check out mine, and we'll be signing tomorrow at 5:15 in the South by Bookstore. Thank you so much.